And I am going to mute all. And everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. So welcome all to the new year and our first Q&A session of the year. So we've got a bunch of stuff in the queue. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Alan to take us through the deck. And Alan, you have to unmute yourself.
If I unmute myself, I can say, and now you should be able to see the title slide.
And we do.
Okay. So happy new year, everyone. It is a new year, and we've got lots of new things, some good and some bad, I guess. We'll start off with a follow-up on the New Year's resolutions. I suggest that everybody should take into account at the last Q&A. And I just want to point out this directory listing of my disk image backup folder. And you will notice that I took my own advice and I did make a disk image of my entire system on the 31st of December. So I hope everybody else is similarly protected. And the second follow-up is from Chris.
Yeah, okay. So at the Q&A last week, we had a question about autoplay on audio CDs, and the person was not able to get it working. So I, not having ever set that, I decided to look into it and see if it worked on my computer. So if you do a search for CDs, it will pop up with the results and show you that there is a control panel applet that will actually do that. And if you click on that, there are a lot of autoplay options on there. And so I decided I would set it to play audio CDs automatically, and it didn't work. And then I noticed at the top of the dialog box, there's a checkbox for use autoplay for all media and devices, and it wasn't checked. And so when I checked that, it worked for me. Now, I have this caution here that Microsoft used to have this on by default, that as soon as you put in a CD, it would play whatever content it was, whether it was an audio CD or a program CD, it would run the whatever was defined in the startup routine and so forth. They turned it off for a reason, and that was because there was malicious content that was being distributed through optical media. And as soon as somebody would put that optical media into the disk, into the computer, closed drive, it would autoplay that content and could infect that person's computer. Now, as a follow-up to the follow-up, I guess, is that the person who had the problem initially said that, yes, indeed, they did have that checkbox saying, use autoplay for all media and devices, and it still didn't work on their computer. So while this may not work for everybody, it did work for me, and I promptly went and turned it back off again because of the dangers involved in having that on there.
And I assume that Natalie, when she checked that box, she also changed some of the options from take no action, because that wouldn't.
Yeah. I don't know if she tried all of them. There is the, there's another one under, I guess it's DVDs, there's enhanced content or something like that. So, but I presume she tried every play option that was there. She did say that she had tried using VLC as well as Windows Media Player, and it just wouldn't work for her.
That's really strange.
Yeah,
that's the other thing I was going to suggest, try VLC, but if that doesn't work either, then I don't know what to suggest. Windows Feedback Hub, I guess.
I guess, yeah.
So she says thanks for trying. All right, so the third New Year's resolution I gave everybody was to share programs and apps with the group. And you'll find as we go along that both Andrew and Stuart took my advice, and we have some information, basically shares from those people. And the first one, in fact, is from Andrew, and I guess it's for all you deadbeat Windows 7 users out there who haven't upgraded to Windows 10 yet. And although Microsoft in theory turned the tap off and you shouldn't be able to upgrade, apparently you still can. And there's a link here from the Make Use Of website, which suggests that you still can upgrade to Windows 10 if you wish.
Yeah, all it requires is a valid license key for Windows 7 or Windows 8, and you should be able to do the upgrade to 10.
And our next share is from Chris again.
Yeah, okay. Let me just I'm pasting in all of the URLs into the chat if anybody wants to pick them up there. This is the Ouch newsletter, which is put out by the SANS Institute. They're securing the human part of the organization. They put out a monthly security newsletter, and this month is on 5 steps that they think are necessary to secure home wireless network. I question a little bit step number 5, whether it's really necessary, but overall it's a good article. It's about a page or two, I guess, worth of information. And I highly recommend that people subscribe to the Ouch newsletter. It's once a month, comes out. It's consumer level information. They call themselves the security newsletter for everyone. And very easily digestible security information, sort of stuff that novices can definitely act on and things like that. So really, really good information. Comes out once a month. Highly recommended.
Okay. And moving on again to another share, this time from Stuart. He's found a source of technical news called The Markup, themarkup.org. And on their homepage, there's a couple of items which they offer. And one of them is called Simple Search. And the reason is they say that if you search in Google, as most people do, and when you see the results, you'll find that the top results are always related to Google-only products. So clearly there's a little bit of... Beg your pardon?
They wouldn't do that.
Oh, there's a slightly friendly bias, shall we say then. So basically these authors have built this browser extension called Simple Search. And right now it's only available for Firefox and Chrome, so I couldn't actually try it out myself. But basically what it does is it finds the regular search results, like the non-Google ones, and overlays them on top of Google's own results page. So basically, if you search for John Cho, whoever he is, some kind of actor, I believe, then you can see that there's this overlaid box with the markup results, the simple search results, overlaid on top of the Google results. Interesting, this is straight from their website. This isn't a particularly good example because it strikes me, if you look carefully, the simple search results are exactly the same as the Google results. So it's not really a very good advert for their product, but maybe on other sites it does the right thing. Anyway, that's worth noting if you're anti-Google, I guess, or want more detailed results. And then the second product which the markup has is called Blacklight. And Blacklight is essentially a privacy inspector for websites. So you can enter a URL into their webpage and it will go and scan this website and find all the bad things. And it must work really, really well, because if you notice, I search for opcug.ca, well-known haven of spammers and malefactors. And when you look at the results, you'll find that our website has no ad trackers, no third-party cookies, no tracking that evades blockers, no session recording services, nothing capturing keystrokes. Facebook Pixel, whatever that is not found. And Google Analytics remarketing audiences we don't do that either. So we must be a really good website. So that's if you're interested in checking up on websites, that's at least one online source where you can do that. And then the third share that Stuart sent us is for a calendar app. And this is the people that do Proton Mail or Proton VPN. And they're apparently building a cross-platform calendar that doesn't have anything to do with Google or shuts Google out or something. And right now it's in beta. And it's supposed to be free once they release a final version. But for now, it's on the Google Store, Google Play Store. But it's only available for people who are paid to use Proton Mail or Proton VPN. And Stuart notes that the Play Store says it's compatible with all his devices. I assume including that special smartphone he's using tonight for Zoom. And then the final one from Stuart is a cloud computer. So everybody's heard about cloud computing, where basically you store your life's work on somebody else's computer on the web. Now, how about using a cloud computer? And there are versions of this around. I guess to some extent, if you're running a virtual web server on somebody's computer on the web, then that's essentially a cloud computer of a sort. And however, this one is basically aimed at gamers. So what they're doing is they're going to sell you a high-performance web-based computer so you can run all your fancy games that eat up graphics cycles and need you to sell your firstborn in order to buy a suitable graphic card. So for $12 a month, they will basically sell you a graphics box that will do everything your little heart desires. So if you're interested in that, you can go and take a look at shadow.tech.
Tom just put into the chat that he thinks AWS, Amazon Web Services, offers a free year. Now, I don't know if they have high-performance graphics cards available on their computing platform or whatever, but that would be another option to check out, I guess, and see if it's free for a year.
Yeah, you might want to put the acronym, the name of the acronym, in the chat window, Chris.
Yeah, okay, so.
AWS may not mean a lot to a lot of people.
I think it's Amazon Web Services.
I think that's
right.
It
might be servers. But.
No, I think it's services. I think you're right. So our first question tonight is about another follow-up kind of thing on, it's actually from Martin, on Wi-Fi extenders. If you remember, he heard Lawrence's presentation on Wi-Fi and then decided to buy an extender. And what he's telling us is that on the unit he's got, it has an adjustment for strength of the coverage, essentially. And you can have maximum, mid, or minimum. And he wants to know if there are any implications for performance depending on which option you choose. So Chris and I decided this was a little odd. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah. I sort of wonder, I mean, if you have an extender, why would you want to limit the power of it? We did have a bit of discussion before the start of Q&A with Lawrence on the line. And, the general consensus seems to be that why not use the max setting? I think that there's potentially an idea that an engineer somewhere thought that you might want to limit propagation beyond the boundaries of your locale where you don't need a signal to actually go to, potentially being picked up by other people or something like that. But I personally don't see any reason not to use the max setting. Lawrence seemed to think that there's a possibility that it could be putting out too much power interfering with other things, that you might want to lower it. But by and large, I think the consensus seems to be go with the max, and if it seems to cause any problems, then try backing off and see if it makes any difference.
Yeah,
Is this
you're trying to shut your neighbors out.
Yeah. Is this a matter of a trade-off between speed versus distance from the router?
No, that would be using either the 5 gigahertz or the 2.4 gigahertz is going to define distance versus speed trade-offs. So I think this just is a power setting.
Lawrence believes this is a specific to this particular extender, which is a TP-Link. Right, Lawrence?
Correct. And Googling that specific reference only came up with a TP-Link extender. And the TP-Link extender basically says, you have the setting to set it at minimum, medium, or maximum, with a nice little graphic to explain, just in case you don't know what those three terms are. But then it says, go to the manual to see more details. Well, you go to the manual to see more details, and I finally found the manual online, and it basically just reiterates the same thing. So,
at least it doesn't tell you to go to the website for more detail.
Yeah. So anyways, I don't know. As just what Chris said, the only thing I can think of is having a max setting on an extender may overpower the signal coming from the source. But then what's the point of having an extender if it's just going to interfere with the host information? Don't know. We would need to see what the engineer thought or intentions were. If assuming it's just pure marketing snake oil.
Yeah. I would be willing to bet that it defaults to max, and I would just leave it that way.
Is there a possibility if the extender is too close to the router that the max setting might cause interference?
Well, that's what Lawrence is saying.
I'm thinking of wave dynamics.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Jocelyn's found a link here. 8 reasons to turn down the transmit power of your Wi-Fi. So maybe there is some rationale to it.
Yeah. So whoever asked it, check out that link and see if it makes sense to you. Otherwise, try max, and if it doesn't seem to cause any problems, it'll give you presumably longer extension that you can move your extender farther away from the base station and get more coverage.
And try min and see if you can get anything.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. You've got the switch, so you can just try it and see what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But max certainly seems like the obvious thing to do. Okay, moving on to the next question from Martin, which we touched on briefly. Some devices hit the 2.4 gigahertz band and other times are on 5 gig. Is there any reason to have a device stay on one of those two bands? Chris.
Yeah, so the idea behind the two bands is that you're trading off distance over speed. So 2.4 gigahertz will give you farther propagation of the signal than 5 gigahertz, but 5 gigahertz gives you potentially faster speeds than 2.4 gigahertz. So you have to sort of trade off between those two. So I'm saying, like, if you want maximum speed, you know, and you're within the range for 5 gigahertz, go with 5 gigahertz. If you're iffy on the range, you're farther away from the base station and you tend to be losing connection, then switch down to 2.4 gigahertz, which give you farther propagation but potentially lower fastest speeds. Now, I say potentially because, you know, if you were paying for, say, 30 megabit bit per second on your internet connection, well, 2.4 gigahertz is going to give you more speed than that. So if your concern is the, you know, your speed out to the internet, in most cases, you're going to find that your internet connection is the limiting factor, not your Wi-Fi. So in that case, I would go with the 2.4 gigahertz, just get the extra distance. There is one other thing that since I sent in my comments on this that I thought about, and there are some instances where if you have multiple devices that need to talk to each other over your Wi-Fi, they typically have to be on the same band. So if you have one thing that's on the 2.4 gigahertz, and I'm talking mostly smart home devices, and you have a a smartphone app or something that talks directly to that device, typically they will have to be on the same band. And so you might have a limiting factor there as well.
Don't you also have the problem of sometimes you've got other devices that are not really on the network, but they're running at 2.4 gig, like microwave ovens?
Yeah, I've heard of that. I think that, microwave ovens and stuff like that, electric motors and things like that can often be interfering on the 2.4 gigahertz. Bob Walker, you know, I think you've looked into this a little bit more, have you not, in terms of interference on bands?
You're muted.
Or Lawrence, do you have any comments about bands?
I think Bob's trying to say something, but he's muted.
He's muted, though. I can't unmute him.
I can request his unmute.
He's still chatting.
Okay.
There he goes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I looked into this briefly. My antivirus software did a scan of my network actually just before this meeting. And it came up with 19 devices. And the reality is a lot of the smart home devices only work on 2.4 gigahertz anyway.
Yeah.
So I tend to reserve the any 5 gigahertz items to things like my laptop computer and anything else that's sensitive to the speed. It's actually hardwired in, like my smart TV, my satellite receiver, and things like that. So it's not such an issue. But I find out that the farther ends of my house here, the 5 gigahertz is getting pretty weak.
Yeah. What speed is your internet connection?
I'm on a wireless internet with a tower that's only about half a kilometer away. At best, I can get about 10 megabytes a second.
In that case, I would switch to 2.4 gigahertz because your internet connection is the limiting factor by far. You know, your Wi-Fi signal is going to be on 2.4 gigahertz is going to be way faster than your internet connection is.
Yeah, not only that, my upload speeds are pathetic because the way they balance these things out with this rural wireless internet is you can get decent enough download speeds to stream high definition video for one user.
Yeah.
But the upload speeds tend to be very, very slow. And that's why for example, when I gave my presentation on November 11th, their Computers at War, and I was trying to upload at these ridiculously low speeds, there was occasional stall in my presentation.
Right. Yeah, Tom mentioned that 10 megabytes per second is great, but I'm sure you're talking 10 megabit per second that you're getting. Also, there was a comment from Bob Harris that he heard 2.4 gigahertz may be better at going through walls. And
yes.
He was question mark on that.
No question mark. Yes.
Okay. So in outside of somebody who has like a really high speed internet connection, I would say you're better off going with 2.4 gigahertz. As Alan pointed out, there is a possibility of interference on the 2.4 gigahertz band with things like microwave ovens and things like that. So I guess there's no easy answer to it. You just have to test and see. But I would say, you know, most things sound like you're better off on 2.4 gigahertz. Try that. And if you do get interference or things like that, then switch to the 5 gigahertz. but realize that then you may have distance issues that you'll have to deal with. And then you need the extender, and then you have to decide whether you want your extender on max power.
I think it'd be better to actually try it with the 5 gigahertz or 5 megahertz because you'll get better bandwidth and also you'll have less interference from other people. And only use 2.4 where 5 doesn't work.
But 5, you are dealing then possibly with distance issues, right? So, because 2.4 gigahertz will propagate farther distances than 5 gigahertz and go through walls better than 5 gigahertz. So.
That's what he means by if it works or if it doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
So everything's a trade-off, right?
You don't yeah, exactly. So you have to try one thing, try another, and so forth. Yeah. Interesting, though.
Okay, so I had 3 resolutions for you, and the second one was that you were going to ask a question at Q&A and find one that nobody could answer. We've almost done that. Anyway, it is that time.
Hopefully not that nobody can answer.
We've got a lot of scratching our heads and maybes there, I think. Anyway, it is that time. I've run out of prepared material, so... If there are any other questions or shares, comments on anything interesting, Stuart was going to talk about something.
Ask a question?
Yes, certainly. Go ahead.
Okay, so I have a new computer, and it has both solid-state drive and hard drive. And it seems that it's set up that everything is going to the solid-state drive. And I'm just wondering, is there an easy way for me to reroute, you know, like the documents, the downloads, all that kind of stuff to the hard drive?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Well, for example, you can set your word processor the default location to save files for your hard drive, for example, if that's what you want. You can tell the browser to download to a specific folder on any drive you want.
Okay, so I have to do all of those things separately, right?
Okay, Alan, let me take over sharing because I'll show one thing with the libraries, which can be useful. If I can see my controls, I went and resized my resolution, and now I've lost my controls. So let me just. See if I can get that back. There we go. Okay, so share screen. And I think I have to share my entire screen because what I want to show is in File Explorer. So is everybody seeing my File Explorer window?
Yes.
Okay. So for the libraries on your computer, such as documents, pictures, all of the standard libraries. If you go and right-click on Documents and you go to Properties, and it'll bring up the Properties dialog box, and then you can specify the location. And so what you can do is specify, in this case, you would go to D, you know, whatever you want, Documents, D:\Documents or whatever, and you could move your existing documents to that location, and then that would change the default for documents to be that. So you can move all your libraries quite easily by doing that. The other thing is just to stop using Drive C for things. And Alan has given presentations on organizing of files before where he does that. And so he just has locations on a different drive for his documents, and that's where he saves his documents. You can do likewise when you're installing programs. With programs, you're going to have to reinstall, you know, uninstall it and then reinstall it and say you want to install it to D:\Programs or whatever. So you can't easily move a program folder. But basically you can stop the bleeding by just stopping saving things, move your libraries such as documents, music, pictures, and so forth, move those to your D drive, and then if you want, you could recover that extra space on programs by uninstalling them and reinstalling them to the hard drive.
The other question that comes to mind is, are you concerned about dumping everything onto your solid-state drive? Because typically, these are pretty big these days, so you probably got lots of space.
That's a good point.
Yeah, well, I mean, I normally have things downloaded, and then I move them. I have two external drives that I use as backups. So it's just that the difference in size is kind of big between the solid state and the regular hard drive. So just for regular stuff before I move them or delete them or whatever, I kind of prefer them to go to the hard drive rather than the solid state. I don't know. Is that, like, does it matter?
Well, I think Alan makes a good point in that if you've got lots of space on the solid state, you know, do you really worry about it? But certainly if you are getting anywhere near low space, and I consider low space anything under about 25 to 30% free space is low. Outside of that, maybe it's easier just to keep things on your solid state drive and everything will run quicker. It can simplify things for backups if you're only backing up one physical device, I guess. There is an option for that. But I did I went through that myself in that I have a solid state drive that is 500 gig, I guess. And I decided that I would just put a data directory on my physical hard drive, which is a terabyte. And I just save documents there. And so I didn't bother with programs and things like that. And as I look at things right now, I've got on my C drive, which is a solid state drive, I've got almost 400 gigabytes free space of 500 gigabytes. And my data drive, which is actually it's 2 terabyte drive, I've got 1.2 terabytes free space on there. So I've got lots of space on both. I don't need the speed on the stuff that I put onto my hard drive for the most part, although I do have my entire photo library there, and that's indexed, so that's probably slower than it has to be. But, having some kind of balance like that I find works for me. But whatever works for you, as long as you don't run out of space.
Yeah, I think I was looking, because it's a new computer right now, and I have probably almost everything on my external drives at the moment, but I'm kind of looking down the road, like how to set it up for the future. And I have half what you have. I have 256 and 1 terabyte. So, I just wasn't sure what the best way to go would be.
I don't think there's one best way. Everybody's circumstances are going to be a little bit different. And so you have to just juggle things, look at where your space is and what you want the fastest access to things, balancing those sort of things for your particular situation.
Okay.
I understand the idea, though, as on a new computer, you want to sort of start it off on the right foot.
Yeah, I don't want to have to worry about it later or, not be able to move things I'm going to set it up now.
Yeah, I find that by and large, how big is your solid state drive?
256.
256. I mean, for the most part, unless for programs and the operating system, that's a lot of space. Mm-hmm. So it's actually very easy to move data at any point in time. So you could even keep your data on your solid state drive as well. And then if you decide later on, I'm getting a little bit low on space at that point, move your entire documents folder or your pictures if it's that, or if you have huge videos, decide at that point to move them to your spinning hard drive would mm-hmm. be an option. It's pretty easy to move documents. It's not so easy to move programs.
Okay. And so you mentioned backup. So for ease of whatever, leaving all the programs on the solid state and just having that in one place for backup would be easy?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I probably shouldn't have said that it's necessarily easier to deal with backups on one physical drive rather than two. I find it quite easy to, my backup process, I have it backing up both my solid state drive and my 2 terabyte spinning hard drive. It's you know, I just define the backup task as backing up both those devices. So it's not really any harder to deal with two physical devices rather than one.
Okay, thanks.
Bob had a comment. He has programs on his SSD, manually saves everything else to his spinning hard drive under D files with many folders, et cetera. And that's what Alan does as well, and that's what I do as well.
Actually, no, I don't do that. But what I do is I actually have all my program, all the operating system, all my programs on the solid state drive, on the C drive. All my data is in a dedicated data partition, which is a D drive in Windows, on the solid state drive.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But I keep that fairly lean and mean. So I probably only have like 5 gig of data at any one time.
Oh, okay.
So all of my pictures are basically archived, and they are on a number of external USB drives.
Ah, gotcha.
And my backup images go onto the external USB drive. It's important the backup is on a different drive, a different physical drive than the operating system, because if that disk crashes, then you need to have a backup available somewhere else.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, see, I could do that.
As Chris says, it's basically, you know, whatever works for you best.
Yeah. I sympathize with you a little bit in the, having a lean and mean data partition. My pictures alone on my spinning hard drive are 651 gigabytes.
But you must look at those every day then. So, I mean, I don't have that many, but I've got some, but I almost never look at my digital pictures. They just sit on that archive drive somewhere. Terribly sad, really.
I've heard they're all selfies, too.
Yeah, keep
okay, more questions, people.
Well, if there's no questions, I could give
Mike. Mike Pence says, hearing none. I'll stop sharing, and Chris is going to take over.
Okay, so I'm going to, if I can find which document it is to share. Just a second here. This is really odd. I'm not seeing that. Oh, show all windows. Okay. Let's see.
You need to get rid of that terabyte drive, Chris. You can't find anything.
Well, this is really weird because it's not actually showing me the proper window for PowerPoint. So let me try closing down a few of my running windows here and see if that causes them to show up. And close. And I'll try close windows. If I can't get this to work real quickly, I will switch over to just share my whole screen. But let me try this. Okay, now I see it. Okay, so do you see DNS and security on screen?
Yes.
Okay, so this question, how did this actually come up, Alan? I can't remember. There was a question sent in talking about
Stewart's.
It was a specific service that's available as a DNS replacement. So I decided I hadn't used it specifically. It came out of last week's Q&A where I talked very briefly about the performance.cira.ca to do speed tests on your internet connection. And Stuart was on their site and happened to notice that they had a DNS service on there and asked whether that had been discussed before. And I don't think we ever discussed it specifically. And so I looked a little bit at what their offering is. and I culled some other information from some security presentations I've given in the past. So I'm going to talk a little bit about DNS and how security can be enhanced by using DNS services. So what is DNS? Okay, so your computer doesn't know how to get to a domain name. So when you go to, say, your browser and you type in the URL field, opcug.ca, your computer has no clue about how to get to a domain name. It does know how to get to an IP address, okay, which is that, you know, 64.355 or 255 or 254.10.2 or whatever. And so it knows how to get to that. So how does that translation happen between opcug.ca and the IP address of the server that it's actually sitting on? It's the domain name service, or DNS. And what it does, its sole job really, is to translate domain names to IP addresses. It can be used for other things, but that's really what it was designed to do in the first place. So how DNS actually works. So you type opcug.ca into the URL of your browser, and the computer says, well, I don't know how to get to a domain name. I know how to get to an IP address. So what I will do is I will ask a DNS server the IP address for opcug.ca. And so every time you configure a computer for internet access, one of the things, or it's usually two fields, it'll ask for the IP address of a DNS server. And so it will go to that server and it will ask, what is the IP address for whatever you typed in? The DNS server will respond with the IP address for the domain name that you typed in. And then your computer will send the browser to the IP address. In the URL field, it still shows it as opcug.ca, but it is actually going to the IP address of that particular server. So let's imagine that OPCUG is compromised. I can actually say this because we don't host our website anymore. Back when it was mine, the server was actually sitting in my house. I would never actually suggest that OPCUG could actually get compromised, but seeing as it's hosted somewhere else, we'll assume that it gets compromised and every visiting computer gets attacked automatically as soon as the person connects to it. So the computer says, DNS, what's the IP address for opcug.ca? The DNS server responds with the IP address for opcug.ca is 99.79.139.204. The computer sends the browser to that address, and then the computer gets attacked because it's a compromised site. Let's talk about using DNS for security. So
Chris, there's a bit of a lag. And you're changing the build and the slide showing up.
Oh, okay. I'll slow it down then. So are we okay for the last slide, or do you want to look at it again?
Right now we're on the using DNS slide. There we go. Now we're on imagine OPCUG is compromised.
Holy cow, that took a long time to throw up. Okay, my apologies. Okay, so again, we're going to assume that opcug.ca, the server, has been compromised, and that every visiting computer is being attacked as soon as they connect to it. So in this case, we're going to say computer. The computer is going to say, DNS, what's the IP address for opcug.ca? In this case, what we're going to have is a DNS that knows that opcug.ca has been compromised. And the DNS is going to respond with, the IP address for opcug.ca is, and it'll give some other IP address, which is actually a warning page. So in this case, it'll take you to a web page that actually just says, here there be dragons, and it'll prevent you from getting to that compromised server and having your computer compromised by attacking, as soon as you attach to it. So by virtue of the fact that the DNS server knew that opcug.ca is a compromised server, it can actually lie and say that the destination is somewhere else. There is a case that, and I'll talk very briefly about it later on, there's one service I know of that rather than sending you to a warning page, they just won't resolve the address. And so if it's a compromised site that they think you shouldn't go to, you'll just get, you know, site not found or something like that, whatever, you know, standard error messages when it's just not defined. So in this case, it sends the computer to that other address and displays that warning page, and your computer is safe. So this is what a replacement DNS service can do for security. There are a number of ones that are free that are available out there, and we'll talk about a couple of them. So this is Canadian Shield, and this is the one that is run by CIRA that Stuart came across. So it is run by the Canadian Internet Registration Authority, so presumably a trustworthy organization. They claim, and I put a number of things here in quotes because this is actually off their website. I don't know how to validate what they really mean by some of these things. They say they block 100,000 new malicious domains every day. That's pretty significant to be adding 100,000 new malicious domains every day. They claim that they are partnered with Akamai. Akamai is an organization that does their original raison d'etre was to multi-host content around the world. And so any site that expected a lot of traffic, they could actually host it on Akamai, and everybody would get good response worldwide on it. I did not know that they had actually gotten into defining malicious domains. So apparently they have, because CIRA partnered with them for this service. They also claim they get threat feeds from top security vendors, whatever that means, and the open source community, whatever that means. So they don't define what their top security vendors are, and they don't define how they get open source community input into what constitutes a threat. They do have Canadian data centers in Vancouver, Toronto, and Montreal. It's spread out. They also use, and I forget the term, it's a technology where you will automatically be directed to whichever is the closest and fastest connection to you. So you don't have to actually decide, I want to pick Vancouver, Toronto, or Montreal. You just put in the one IP address for their DNS, and it'll just automatically find the best host to use. Under privacy, they say they have no interest in using your data for marketing purposes or in selling it to others. Interestingly, they don't say we don't use your data for marketing purposes or selling it to others. They say they have no interest in it, but that's not to say they don't do it, I think. Anyhow, I suspect strongly that from a privacy point of view, it's pretty good. They do have three protection levels, and actually it's really two protection levels, because the first one, it just keeps your DNS private, data private from any third parties so that other people don't know where it is that you're visiting, but it offers no protection at that level. Then you have two protection levels. The first one is protected, where it'll do everything. It'll do your private stuff, plus it'll do malware and phishing blocking. And then they have family, which will do your private malware and phishing blocking, and it'll block pornography. And they don't define what they mean by pornography or how they determine whether something is pornography. And the URL is there if you want to go to it and then implement it on your particular computer. Next one I want to talk about is Quad9. This was actually begun by IBM, and then they spun it off to Cleaner DNS, which is a nonprofit corporation that is incorporated in California. And they have a whole bunch of other intelligent partners, 19 of them, that are now involved in this. They say they block 60 million accesses to malicious websites per day. They claim over 800 terabytes of threat intelligence information. That is how they determine whether something is malicious or not. They have over 150 locations in 88 nations, and they claim that they are at the internet exchange points, are very close to them. And so they say that the time to get answers from their DNS is lower than, quote, unquote, almost any other solution. In privacy, they do state they no personally identifiable information is collected. I don't know if they collect information that is not personally identifiable. They only have one level of protection, and that's malicious threats. So they won't do anything about pornography or things like that. But for malicious intent, that is their focus. That's what they will block. And they are the ones that will not return a page that says, you know, you don't want to go to this particular website. They just fail the lookup. And so you'll get site not found or whatever. And www.quad.net is the address where you can go to find out more information. They're also the easiest one, I think, to use because the DNS for it is 9.9.9.9, quad 9. Neustar Ultra DNS Public, they have 30 nodes on 6 continents, and they claim that it is to prevent access to malicious websites known for malware, phishing, spyware, and bots. And that's their quote. I don't know exactly what that really means, but overall it sounds like it's pretty good. They have 2 levels of protection. So they have 1 level which will do malware, ransomware, spyware, and phishing. So basic, you know, protection against bad things like that. And then another level which will do all of that plus gambling, pornography, violence, and hate discrimination. And again, they don't do anything to define what they determine or how they determine that something is a violence site or a hate discrimination site or gambling. Gambling is fairly straightforward, I guess, but probably not even that. But if you're interested in that, there's the URL for it is public DNS Neustar. Well, I should point out these are all free of charge too for personal use. Some of them have corporate use that you can pay for and things like that, but these are all free for personal use. Now, the last one I want to talk about is OpenDNS Home and OpenDNS Family Shield. And I used to recommend this, and it'll come clear in a moment why I don't necessarily recommend it anymore. If you look at the 2 free options, you'll see that there's actually a gap in there. Okay, built-in protection for malicious phishing and malware domains. That, to me, was the main reason why I was recommending that people use a replacement DNS. And the free options on here no longer offer that. Okay, and that to me is kind of critical. So I no longer recommend it, except there is one aspect, and if you do OpenDNS Home, they have one thing on there called customizable content filtering. And if you use that, you can actually go in and choose any of 59 categories of filtering. And you can see on the list, I mean, it's incredible the different kinds of things that you can decide you want blocked on your network. Notice none of this is to do with malicious intent, okay? None of it is malware, sites that are going to attack you as soon as you connect to them or anything like that. But if in your home you decide that you want to block file storage or sites about drugs or dating sites or lingerie, you know, you can go in. They don't say how they determine the blocking, but you could go in and you could actually pick out any or all of those particular types of domains that you want blocked in your browser. So if that's your aim, sure, go ahead with OpenDNS Home and define the categories that you want blocked. But realize that you are not, at the free level, getting any malicious intent blocking. Okay, so Chris's picks. And these are in order for what I think is you know, best for my needs. I think the best is actually Quad 9. I think it's the most comprehensive when it comes to threat intelligence. The fact that it was started by IBM and then they went out to 19, actually 18 because they're one of the 19, and they define all 19 of the threat intelligence companies that they're involved with, and there's some pretty big names on there. It's not so good for family friendly because it won't block anything except things for malicious intent. So it won't block porn, it won't block gambling, things like that. The next up, I think, is probably Canadian Shield, run by Sierra. And I think it's probably good protection, and the fact that they're going out with Akamai, I presume that there's some reasonable level of threat intelligence behind it all. I do think that Sierra is quite trustworthy. You can do just security or security and pornography, nothing beyond pornography. If you want to wave the Canadian flag, that's the one to do is there. If you're concerned about your DNS data being shared cross-border, all their servers are in Canada. So, you know, you will have an assurance that everything is stays at home. The next one down would be OpenDNS, home or family shield only if you need that web blocking by category. Keep in mind that you do not get any security protection from that particular solution. Neustar, I put it last on the list just because they seem to be more opaque about where they're getting their threat intelligence data from. They do have two levels of protection, you know, either the just threat protection or the family, which included those broad categories of four different categories on there. So that's my take on a replacement DNS servers, how it can enhance your security, and I'll throw it open for any questions anybody might have.
Some comments in the chat window, Chris. Tom says, IP address is recognized by routers and the internet for routing. Domain name is not.
Yeah.
And the problem with the delay, obviously, I need to put my extender to max or something because nobody else is having the delay problem, apparently.
Okay, good to know. just a word before I forget about this. If ever anybody is seeing delays when we're presenting in Q&A, shout out right away and we will slow it down. Don't let this just go by thinking like, oh, maybe I'm the only one. Well, maybe you're not the only one, and even if you are the only one, we can slow it down so that you don't miss content.
And Eldon, I think, has a question about IP addresses. And what's the significance or the way the numbers and number groups are formulated, and what do they actually mean?
The first sets of numbers, and I very conveniently don't define what sets really means, is the network. And then the last set or sets of numbers are the hosts that are on a particular network. And the reason why I can't define it is that a Class A network would actually just have the network would be the first set of numbers, the first of the four sets, and then the computers would be the other ones on that. Most people on their home networks, they actually define what is known as a Class D network, which is the first three sets of numbers are actually defining the network, and then the last set of numbers define the computers that are on that particular network. That was the oldest style of defining IP addresses. They went to a classless a long, long time ago because IP addresses were being taken up at an enormous rate, and you'd have some people with Class A networks which can actually have 16 million computers on their particular network, and they were using, you know, a couple of thousand or 10,000. And so this idea of dividing up the networks that way was a very, very inefficient way of doing it. And so they actually went to a classless. By and large, you really don't have to worry a whole lot about it. When you are defining a network, you do define what is known as the mask, which is the characters or the sets of numbers that are defining the network and the sets of numbers that are defining hosts on the network. But outside of that, you know, don't worry an awful lot about it.
Tom is saying that a website, opendns.com, is useful for filtering web addresses.
Which number?
OpenDNS.com.
Okay, they're open. That's the one that I talked about there. So the OpenDNS home allows you to do that where you're blocking by category. But again, on that particular one, you, if you're not paying for it, then you're not getting any built-in protection for malicious content. All that it will allow you to do is to define the categories of websites that you want blocked.
Tom again says DNS filtering is also good for IoT, Internet of Things devices, put in the router.
There is a security panel. I've made a link for it in the chat called setting blah 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 security, and it allows you to block malicious sites and so on. But I can, let me bring it up. I can actually show you if I can.
Yeah, I'll, just a second. I'll have to allow you to share. So okay. Let me, I'll make you a co-host. Okay, so you should be able to share now.
Okay. Share screen, and I got to choose the right one. I guess this is it.
The top share. Left one will give you your whole screen. Okay, got it?
So now this is for my, this is what I use actually for, Internet of Things for my, TV and, phone basically.
Yeah.
And any tablets I have on. And, this is in, this is in security. I guess it's here.
Yeah. Now the problem I have with that is if you read the description of malware botnet protection, you know, it says, at this time, this feature blocks Configure and the Internet Explorer zero-day exploit. That's it. And is continuously updated to include other types of malicious sites. I don't, you know, if they come out and they explicitly say it covers two things, oh, and we do other stuff. I don't think so.
Well, it doesn't. It says continually expanded. I don't know whether it's continually expanded to cover thousands of IPs or whether it's continually expanded to have two or three or a dozen. But all I'm saying is that they do have some filtering of some malware. And it says known phishing sites as well. And, of course, internal internet addresses.
Yeah. It's just that if you're after malware protection, there are sites that specifically state that they do a lot more. And if you look at the slide of comparison that I had, the idea of how much you can get, they do malware blocking on the paid, but they specifically say no on the free offerings. And so this idea, I suspect that they do Configure and the Internet Explorer exploit, and I bet they don't do very much else on the free offerings.
I do use Quad9 on my computer, but I use OpenDNS on my router for my TV and phone.
Yeah, probably not a bad route to go with, you know, have multiple different sources for like that. Yeah, for Internet of Things, you're less likely to be concerned about general malware that's out there. So, yeah, that might be a reasonable way of going about doing it.
So apparently, Jocelyn also needs to change the setting on his Wi-Fi extender because he says, I also see the delay and it matched closely what Alan was saying.
Okay. Well, it shouldn't be due to me. I have, I think, 20 megabit per second upload speeds. So, it's you guys.
So Justin's asking, do you have any comments for Google DNS?
Sure, it's great DNS, but it doesn't do anything for malware. So it's their aim is to provide good, fast DNS that does no logging. Or actually, I'm not sure. Theirs might be minimal logging, that they only log for a day or something like that. But they do nothing in terms of trying to detect malware.
Okay, any more questions, or are we about done and ready to wrap up?
A quick comment on the proceeding there. I was fooling around with Proton VPN, free version, the last week or so, and just on one computer that I use for streaming television content. And at the end of each session, I would shut down my computer and see how much bandwidth, thanks to Chris. There was a way to go into Windows and see what has been using what. And it used to always say that Kodi was sucking up so much of bandwidth after these sessions. But after I started using the Proton VPN, it said that OpenDNS was using all the bandwidth.
That's weird.
And this was the free version of Proton VPN, not the paid version.
That's very peculiar, because I don't understand how OpenDNS could use a lot of bandwidth, because it is strictly DNS. It only uses port 53. Very odd that it would identify that as being OpenDNS.
I'm pretty sure I got the names right. I don't think I got that wrong. But, yeah, I had to sit and stare at the computer for a few seconds.
Yeah.
Go, maybe the paid version of Proton VPN does something different.
Well, I would presume that it was actually identifying Proton VPN, because everything then would be going through Proton VPN, right? So all the traffic should be going through there.
Except it said OpenDNS.
Yeah, very odd. Misidentification, I guess, but very odd.
Stuff happens.
I don't know what OpenDNS could possibly do with all your other traffic that you're sending them. All it is a DNS server.
Yeah.
Okay. Two more slides, I think. Next week is our regular meeting, and you have two presenters, or two presentations, actually, on managing or creating blogs and websites using WordPress, which is generally a free web-based platform for doing these things. I'm going to talk a lot about how to do it, and basically concentrate on the blogging aspect. Just as an example, you'll find out that websites are very similar. And then Bridget, who's our webmaster, is going to talk specifically about using a plugin for WordPress, for a paid version of WordPress called Elementor, which is kind of a special advanced editor, and she'll basically show you how all the pages, or some of the pages on the OPCUD website, are produced and maintained. So if you have any interest in building a blog or starting a website to share information and material, pictures, whatever, with your friends and your families, this is a really easy and zero cost way to get into the business. However, following that, we will have a regular question and answer session after the main meeting. So again, if you have questions or things you want to share, if those New Year's resolutions are still burning a hole in your pocket, send your suggestions to our suggestion box email address.
Before we end, Glenn had a question. Does Blacklight scan for same type of malware as JavaScript scanners, or does it look for different threats? I don't personally know. I haven't used it. I don't think that Alan has done it either. But looking at the slide, it looks like it only looks for ad trackers, third-party cookies, tracking that evades cookie blockers, session recording services, websites that are trying to capture keystrokes, and then it looks for Facebook Pixel and Google Analytics. So it looks like that's what it's limited to, as opposed to, strictly speaking, malicious intent.
Yeah, but that's based on one example, so you might want to check the website and see see what else it might do.
Okay.
Okay, so Happy New Year, everyone. Thanks for attending, and don't forget to send in those questions for next week.
Thanks for showing up, everybody. See you next week.
Thanks again, Chris.
A great session, everybody. See you next week.
Thank you all. Good night. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Where's the leave button? There it is. Night.
Night.
Night, gentlemen.